Hey everybody, this is Hardy Roberts. It is July 13, 2015, and this is the Construction Law Committee of the Florida Bar's monthly meeting. We have Neil Sivier here with us today, who is going to give us a presentation after our subcommittee reports regarding a recent construction licensing decision that he was involved in that came out in May. Before we get into that, though, we'll go through our subcommittee reports. As a reminder, as is our usual custom, we're recording our monthly meetings so that we can get them out as a podcast on iTunes. To get going, let me introduce our officers. Scott Pence is our vice chair. Lee Weintraub is our other vice chair, and Robert Doan is our secretary. The meeting minutes for June were sent out by email. Anybody got a motion to approve?
I moved.
Second,
anyone? Thank you very much. Barring any comments, we'll consider those minutes approved. We'll get into our subcommittee reports. We got a few people that aren't with us today who've let me know, but we'll go through them. Carrie, are you here as our ABA forum liaison?
Yes, I am. The next meeting that we have with the forum is going to be in Austin, Texas, October 8th and 9th, and it's the Construction ADR Summit. I'd encourage you to, if you're going to attend, to register early. Get your hotel reservations as well. That is the weekend in between the 2 weeks of Austin City Limits. So it's going to be a pretty packed place with respect to hotel reservations. So get that. And the music is supposed to be fantastic, so a lot of people are looking forward to attending that. There is also a trial academy this fall, October 21st through the 24th. It is in D.C. at a federal district courthouse, and it is limited to the first 30 that enroll. So if you have younger associates that need some trial practice training, the academy always gets fantastic reviews, and it's a great location. Again, that's October 21st to the 24th. The midwinter meeting is January 21st and the 22nd in San Francisco. And then the annual meeting next year will be late April, April 28th and 30th in Nashville, Tennessee. I'd encourage you, if you're not involved in the forum, give me or Steve Less or anyone involved in the forum an email or a phone call, and we'll get you plugged in. We have 13 divisions plus a young lawyer division. It's a lot of opportunity for people to become involved. And that's my report.
Very good. Thanks, Carrie. Everyone, just as a reminder, I know we've had a lot of people buzz in as well. Check your email for the email that came through about 10:20 a.m. today for the agenda and also the link to record your attendance. So I know we've got a lot of people on the call, so don't forget to jump on that link and let us know you're here. Next up, Deborah Mastin, who chairs our ADR subcommittee. Deb, what's going on?
We are about to launch a self-reporting interactive database for neutrals who are members of the CLC committee initially, and eventually we will roll it out to the entire reptile section. But Brent Zimmerman is creating an interactive database. It's got like 12 different fields. So sometime in the next week or two, you should be getting an email from us, from the committee. If you're not a neutral, you can ignore it, but if you are an arbitrator or a mediator or a dispute board member, it would help all of us to fill it out. Let us know who you are, where you are, and what your particular expertise and experience is. So it'll be a Google Docs thing, similar to the way we record our attendance. And then we're going to post it on the CLC website, and it'll be searchable for all of us to use to find neutrals who are particularly tailored to our disputes.
Very good. Thanks very much, Deb. Check your email. The transaction subcommittee report just went out, and I'll check. The small business one hasn't gone out by email. It will in a second. don't know if Fred Dudley's with us today. I know we don't have a regulatory report. Fred, are you here? I don't think Fred could make it today. So the certification exam, we'll skip that. Next certification review course, Deb or Brian Renzio, you all here?
I'm here. We are gearing up for next year, and we have no report.
All right, very good. I think Reese, CLI, Reese, you're not here, are you? Or you were here briefly?
Reese is not.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll skip CLI unless anybody else on that committee wants to tell us anything.
Yeah, it's Sanjay here. You hear me, Hardy?
Yeah, hey, Sanjay.
Hey, yeah, just as a reminder, just to keep things on people's calendars, the CLI for next year, 2016, is set for March 10 through 12. Golf tournament will be on the 10th, and then we'll run it similar to the way that we have in the past as far as just general schedule. We'll have the reception Thursday night. And then Friday we'll start with the plenary sessions. We'll have another reception, obviously, Friday night. It will be at the same location that we had this year, which was the JW Marriott in Grand Lakes, Orlando. We're still working on the speakers, but we have a pretty interesting and enlightening program.
All right. Thanks, Sanjay. Very good. Next up, Neil Sivier, who's not only our speaker today, but also the chair of our Construction Litigation Subcommittee. Neil, anything going on?
Good morning. Yeah, we have the Hardy, I think you missed the last meeting, but we have a webinar set up on November 9th, 2015, the topic of which will be a failed construction project. The speakers will take the perspective of subcontractor, owner, and general contractor. All our speakers are lined up. Sanjay, Bob Fitzsimmons, John Brown from Attorney's Title, and Giselle. And it will be a half-day seminar. It will be videoed at Stetson Law School in St. Pete. And if this one works out well, we're going to do another one in the first quarter of 2016. So that's pretty much what we're doing.
Very good. Thanks, Neil. No report today from our Construction Regulation Subcommittee. I know we have a report from Clara Margaret Groover, and that report recently we circulated out by email. But, Clara Margaret, what would you like to add?
Well, it's all articulated in the report. It's very short, three cases, but it was particularly interesting to me this go-round. We had an arbitration provision which really reflected a drafter of a contract that really didn't have control of his or her nomenclature, because they referred to in the arbitration agreement the right to go to court only to enforce the mediator's quote decision. The issue here what really was whether there was a duty to arbitrate, and the court held that there was because of several factors. The words of the provision, even though it was labeled mediation, it articulated arbitration, and it said that it was the sole and exclusive remedy available to either party. So I found it really interesting in the case that the appellee argued that, you know, it wasn't really clear that the parties intended for it to be the, quote, sole and exclusive remedy available to either party when the agreement itself actually said that. So that's my snarky comment for the day. There was an interesting case on scope of work in an architect's agreement. And, you know, in drafting architect's agreements, we have basic services and additional services, and sometimes we have optional additional services. And it's clearly intended that additional services in either category will trigger additional fee for the architect. But here we had a sweeping provision. Now, the case actually was decided as a matter of a discovery issue that arose. The case got to the appellate court because there was an issue about whether the owner who had taken the project out of receivership, bought it out of receivership, could enforce a discovery request that would allow would require the architect to have to disclose a whole lot of contract documents under other relationships with third party, you know, third parties that weren't part of that project. So it was interesting. The discussion in there was quite interesting as from a discovery standpoint, but the language of the contract is really what prevented this case from getting resolved early. There is the standard language in AIA documents that says that the architect will perform services that conform to all laws, ordinances, rules, regs, and requirements. It's a standard of care, which is a fairly routine provision. And it said, the original provision said that it would do these things necessary to facilitate project financing and to coordinate/support project marketing, which implies early stage design and construction documents, you know, the timing of generating construction documents. But it really was a question as to whether this was a basic service or additional service, and thus the fight. It's one of those things, most of these cases I report on, I tend to have to sort of say, well, you know, what's the lesson learned here? And of course, if we were to anticipate in our next drafting that we wouldn't just say that the architect has to, this is from an owner standpoint, wouldn't just have to do these things consistent with laws and regs at early stage, like project financing and project marketing, but add language such as I suggest in my report, as well as those services that may be required to meet the requirements of the authority having jurisdiction. In other words, here what happened was the City of Miami Beach required as-built at the end of construction because the construction itself had exceeded the permit. We all know those to be categorized by authorities having jurisdiction as MOD documents, you know, documents that are required as you go through on all of the, you know, to identify what's been done as a because of change orders or field conditions and things. So it's a very fine point, but since that's what I'm supposed to report on, I thought it was particularly interesting. And the last is just a word to the wise in litigating insurance policies. This is a policy they were litigating that had allegedly three copies of the same endorsement. And the endorsement that was critical was the one that appeared in three forms. And so there was a question as to whether it was actually, whether the choice of law provision that was contained in this endorsement really was part of the policy or not. And there was a summary judgment that had been entered in the court below, and so that the appellate court said, no, this is a fact issue. Of course, you've got to go back and resolve that. But what we take away from this is how important it is, particularly in litigation, if your client doesn't already have a copy of the policy very safely tucked away where you can confirm by affidavit that it is the policy that was provided to you as the insured at the beginning of the project, then at least get certified copies of the insurance policies from the carriers at the beginning of your litigation, which of course we can do by means of a 627 letter, or we can also do under the rules of civil procedure once litigation is underway. And the rules of civil procedure, of course, guide us on what that request for production or the interrogatory should say. And that is my report for today.
Thank you, Clara Margaret. We appreciate it. Next up, Contractors University. There's a lot been going on with that. Lee Weintraub and Carrie Wright. What's the report on that?
Well, we're rocking and rolling. The first Contractors University is going to be September 22nd in Fort Lauderdale. And the speakers have been lined up. The written materials are due next week. Carrie and Fred Dudley have been working today on getting an application to the CILB to get CEU accreditation. All the advertising is done. For those of you who don't remember, Contractors University is going to be a new programming initiative of this committee for our members, where a number of our members are invited to present a very different seminar. It's not a legal treatise seminar. It's more, let's talk about, it's presented to contractors, not lawyers. And it's more about. Let's talk about your business practice and how we can put you in a better position to avoid risks and maximize benefits. So, for instance, Fort Lauderdale's topics are going to be going through insurance policies and making sure that the insurance is, the coverage is what it should be, what to do if things happen on the job and you need to make a claim, what types of documents do you need to create, what kinds of damages are available, and how do you do the accounting backup, you know, to make sure you can prove it, that kind of a thing. It's going to be all the contractors universities, there's going to be three of them rotated around the state every year. They're going to be very small, intimate gatherings of perhaps 15 contractors and about five presenters from the CLC. And the whole idea is, like I said, a whole new breed of programming with the ultimate goal of, through the intimacy of it, giving some of our members of the CLC opportunities to develop relationships with potential clients. So September 22nd in Fort Lauderdale is the first rollout presentation. There will be one a couple months later in Tampa and then a couple months after that in Orlando. And then, assuming those all go off the way we expect, we'll pick three new locations for 2016 and keep it going. So.
Thanks, Lee. Anyone, any questions? I think Lee covered it. All right, next up, Legislative Subcommittee, Scott Pence. Scott, you still here with us?
Yeah, I'm still here, Hardy. Thanks. Just real quick, you've heard me report in the past on the Real Property Problem Study Committee of the reptile section has some proposed legislation that would modify the existing what a lot of people refer to as the stop-start statute, the priority of lien statute 71307 under the lien law. We're continuing to work with that committee. Lee Weintraub and I and Alan McCall from that committee have been going back and forth on several drafts, and I've got the latest draft here sitting in front of me to go through today. And then I anticipate that we will have a version of this that at least the three of us have, you know, gotten to a point where we think that it's got, you know, we can agree on it, and we'll each go back to our respective committees, and I anticipate that, that our legislative subcommittee will review this and hopefully get this to a point where we can come back to the full CLC with a recommendation to approve some version of what we've got as of today. So stay tuned, and the intent is that before the next executive council meeting, in which is at the end of this month, where this is to be an action item from the Real Problem Study Committee, to have something that both committees have said we can live with. And that's my report.
Thanks, Scott. Next up, Membership Subcommittee, Arnie Tritt. Arnie Center report. Arnie, are you here with us? All right, Arnie's not here, but we have two new members to welcome since June. Dana Chabin, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, of Schutz & Bowen, and also Todd Coburn of Schutz & Bowen. That now brings us to 631 members, so we're continuing to grow. Next up, our newsletter, Jared Smith. We had a newsletter that we sent out at the last quarterly meeting and that we sent out by email to everyone. We've got a quarterly newsletter that Jared's taken the helm on. We need submissions for that for the next quarterly paper that goes out. Jared, are you here? Anything you want to add?
Yes. Thanks, Hardy. Appreciate it. We had a great first rollout, and I do have an article, a volunteer for an article, and that is Sanjay, and he's going to be writing on changes to the 558. But for our next quarterly one, please give me a shout and shoot me an email, jsmith@rumberger.com. And we would love to consider whatever you've got. So far I haven't turned anybody away.
All right. Thanks, Jared. Publication Subcommittee, no report today. Small Business Programs, Lisa Colon-Heron, you should have in your email about recently the written report from our Small Business Programs Committee. But, Lisa, you want to go ahead?
Yeah, thanks, Hardy. I sent a report. I reported on one case, which is a size appeal case dealing with the ostensible subcontractor rule. And that rule is found in 13 CFR 121.103, subsection H4. And it basically says or provides that when a contractor is usually performing the primary and vital requirements of a contract, or the prime contractor is unusually reliant on the subcontractor, the two firms are affiliated for the purposes of the procurement. In this case, the prime contractor responded to an Army RFP that was a set aside for a small business. In the RFP, it required that the prime contractor submit resumes for three key personnel, and in this case, the small business prime contractor did. It was using a large business as the subcontractor in this case. It submitted the three key personnel's resume. There was eventually a precise protest when it did that on its proposal, and the area office determined that it was that the large contractor subcontractor and the prime contractor were affiliated and violated the ostensible subcontractor rule. That was taken up on appeal, and the Office of Hearings and Appeals found that the area office was incorrect in the facts that it determined. The first set of facts that the area office used to find that there was affiliation, or that the prime contractor was not within its size, was the fact that the that it had not performed contracts within the same size value or that the current procurement was in. And that was just the wrong set of facts. The area office had only used the federal procurement database to determine that, and eventually the prime contractor had submitted other evidence that it did, in fact, perform contracts twice the value of the current procurement. And secondly, the area office had found that by listing three key personnel of the large business subcontractor, that the prime contractor was not going to manage the project, and the Office of Hearing and Appeals found that the area office had read the procurement wrong, that the three key personnel were just three key people that the Army RFP, the contracting officer, wanted to be listed, but that the small business was going to perform and manage most of the projects, and that was made clear by the listing of a program manager and a deputy program manager, which the Office of Appeals found were the key personnel for the small business. And the second part of my report deals with changes to the FAR for the small business subcontracting improvements by the Department of Defense, the GSA, and NASA. And I detail what the proposed changes are, which deals with the SBA regulations that were adopted 2 years ago, and the FAR, parts of the FAR, are coming in compliance with those regulations. The proposed changes are all detailed in my report, and comments are due on August 10th, 2015. That's it, Hardy.
Thanks, Lisa. Next up, our website subcommittee, Brent Zimmerman. Brent, are you here and anything to report today?
I'm here. Nothing really to report other than the stuff will be updated today.
All right. Very good. Thanks, Brent. Next up, TEG subcommittee. Anyone who's interested in helping with the tech stuff that goes on with our committee besides the website, which would be perhaps working and helping on podcast stuff, or if you've got any exciting ideas how to make our meetings more interactive and fun, let me know, and we'd love to get you involved. Next up is our CLE report from Angela Covington, and then she'll introduce our speaker today, Neil Sivier. Angela, take it away.
Thanks, Hardy. There's not any new report for today other than the usual. If anyone has any ideas for a presentation you'd like to hear about, if you know someone who is interested, or maybe we would like to have interested in giving a presentation, please email me. I do believe my email address is in the minutes. As Hardy said, today our CLE presentation will be given by Neil Sivier. Neil is a board-certified real estate and civil trial attorney with the firm of Sivier, Barlow & Watson in Tampa. He has served as the co-chair of the Hillsborough County Bar Construction Law Committee from 2005 to 2008. Neil is AV rated by Martindale Hubbell and has been elected to Legal Elite and Florida Super Lawyers for the last 10 years, and on four occasions was selected as one of the top 100 lawyers in the state of Florida. We're lucky to have him speak today, and he will be discussing the first DCA's decision, Taylor Morrison Services, Inc. versus Carol Echos and Susan Blessing. And this is a case that involved unlicensed contracting, issues about qualifying agents and treble damages. Neil, thank you for giving this presentation today. If you'd like to go ahead.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Hey, Neil, I'm going to, real quick, Neil, let me just mute everybody, and then we'll unmute them when you're done speaking. That way we can keep the interruptions, unless you want to try to do it live, I guess.
No, I was going to suggest that we get the questions via email, if that's okay with everybody.
Okay, good. I'll mute it. Hold on.
Conference is now in silent mode.
All right, Neil, you should be good to go.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. Neil Sivier. What I'm going to do during my presentation is suggest that if anybody has any questions, they send them to me via email, nsivier, S-I-V-Y-E-R, at sbwlegal.com. Again, nsivyer at sbwlegal.com, and that way we won't be speaking over one another, and also if the question is too difficult, I can just ignore it. No, just kidding. Let me tell you about a little bit about the background of the Echos case. This is a case up in Jacksonville that my firm took over from another lawyer representing the builder, and the other lawyer retired, and the case was already about 3 years, I guess, old by the time we got involved. It involved a single house in Jacksonville at that time. That's all it involved. Pretty nice home, about a $400,000 house, I believe. And primarily the claims that were made involved stucco defects, exterior wall system defects, and also framing defects on that house. And there's no question that those types of defects did exist. And the claim was brought not only for the typical claims that you might see, which are, you know, building code defects, negligence, breach of contract, but also there were claims brought for fraud, FIDUPTA, and unlicensed contracting. Those types of claims were brought almost without question to try to bring in attorney's fees, treble damages, punitive damages, as well as other types of claims that you could not recover on for a simple breach of contract or a negligence claim. The contract did involve an arbitration clause, but by the time our firm got involved, the original lawyer had not moved for arbitration, so it proceeded forward in circuit court. Several years after the case had started, a variety of motions for summary judgment were filed, and some hearings were held, and the judge, Judge Haddock up in Jacksonville, did not rule on a number of them for about a year. And then about a year later, much to our surprise, we got an order granting summary judgment in our favor on fraud and FIDUPTA, but against us on the unlicensed contracting claim. And it was really just a two-sentence order. So we obviously were very concerned at that point and moved for rehearing, which was denied without a hearing. So we then, you know, were faced over the next couple of years with considerable discovery. An unlicensed contractor complaint was filed with the DBPR. And the unlicensed contracting complaint was resolved by the DBPR finding that there was no probable cause to even open up an investigation. Nevertheless, we obviously were faced with the summary judgment that had been entered against us on this unlicensed claim. So in order to tee this case up for trial, and really more importantly for an appeal, We stipulated on liability as to construction defects, agreed on an amount of damage for those defects, and had sort of an abbreviated trial so that the court could actually enter some findings and some rulings on why he had found that we were unlicensed to begin with. And basically there were two separate arguments. The argument that was entered or that was argued at the original summary judgment hearing was in essence that the permit had been fraudulently obtained. And obviously everybody's heard the argument that sometimes bad facts make bad law, and that's kind of how we felt that it fell in this particular instance. The qualifier, or one of the qualifiers for my client, the builder, Taylor Morrison, had been signing permit applications in blank in advance, and then the person who would go and get the permits would then fill in the address later and, you know, get the permit issued. In addition, for this particular home, that particular qualifier was no longer employed when the permit was issued. Now, there were several other qualifiers who were, in fact, still with the company when the permit was issued and during construction, but this particular qualifier was no longer employed with Taylor Morrison. Now, she did have an agreement that she would continue to keep her license with the company for a short period of time until she became employed with someone else. And if you want to look at all of the arguments in the briefs that relate to those two issues, the materials that Hardy sent out a couple of hours ago include the appellate briefs, both our brief on appeal, the answer brief, and then the reply brief that was filed by us, as well as the actual District Court of Appeal ruling that was entered about 60 days or so ago. But anyway, so the first argument was that the permit was fraudulently obtained and that therefore we were acting in an unlicensed manner. Now, a summary of our response to that is those are two completely unrelated things. If my client had never obtained a permit at all, ever, we still wouldn't be unlicensed. Under the statute, the test is whether you have a license the date the contract was signed, and we clearly did. And we also clearly had multiple qualifiers as of that date. But that was the first argument that was made successfully, I might add, at summary judgment by the homeowners council. And then the other argument that was made, which really sort of weaved its way in later, right before trial, was that the supervision that was done by the qualifier, who was unquestionably a qualifier during construction and unquestionably went out to the subdivision, is that that supervision was inadequate. And I think the testimony at trial was that this particular qualifier went out to the subdivision every week and made himself available for questions when he was not at the subdivision, but he certainly was not there on a daily basis. We had other employees that were there on a daily basis during construction. And I don't really think that the appeal, the decision on appeal really sort of adequately sets forth those particular facts, but those were uncontradicted facts. And even when the homeowners were dissatisfied prior to the closing, the qualifier himself wrote a letter saying, hey, we'll give you your money back if you don't want to close. But the homeowners elected to close anyway. They felt that they had some equity in the property. So the second argument was that this was inadequate supervision. You didn't spend enough time. You, the qualifier, through your qualifier, didn't spend enough time. If you had been there enough, you wouldn't have all these problems. You wouldn't have code violations, et cetera, et cetera. Now, our response to that was that if you accept this argument, every single construction defect case, you could potentially become unlicensed depending on how often the qualifier was at the job, because the statute does not set forth any requirements as to how often the qualifier has to be on the project. If the project is horrible and the qualifier doesn't do a good job, doesn't come out there often, and doesn't take care of fixing any defects through the company, then that may be grounds for punishing the company or the qualifier. But it doesn't mean you're unlicensed. Again, going back to our first response, if you have a license, the date the contract is signed, you are licensed, period. Whatever penalties that you suffer because of inadequate construction does not make you unlicensed and does not mean you pay treble damages to whatever defects occur on the field. That in essence was our primary argument with regard to the lack of supervision argument. And some of you in Jacksonville may have seen some of the news reports, which are not favorable to the contractor, as you can imagine, and show the plaintiff's attorneys, you know, peeling away some stucco from the wall, and the homeowner complaining that she doesn't have any money to fix the house even after the settlement, et cetera, et cetera. I will tell you in response to that, if you're from that area, that the stipulated amount of damages was paid a couple of years ago, and to my knowledge, there has been no repairs made on the home whatsoever, even as of the last time we knew. But, you know, those are the types of things that can make your client look bad in the media. Again, doesn't mean that you're unlicensed. The oral arguments occurred in front of the First District Court of Appeals, I want to say about 5-6 months ago, and the order that you all have a copy of clearly came down on the side of the contractor. The court basically said, Mr. Builder, it doesn't look very good to have these, these permits issued based upon applications that were signed in blank. And in one instance, I think that the court alludes to the fact that the original qualifier said that Taylor Morrison was not authorized to get her permits under her name anymore. I can tell you her written agreement didn't say that, but she did in fact testify to those reasons. But nevertheless, the court said it's a red light, green light analysis, as one of my associates argued. And that means if you have a permit, the date that the contract is signed, you are not unlicensed. Drawing an analogy to driving a car, I suppose, if you have a license and you speed or you drive irresponsibly or you drunk drive, you certainly could lose your license, you could get a fine, but you can't be charged with unlicensed driving. That would be the simplest analogy I can think of. The First District Court of Appeal, in the materials that you have, agreed with that analysis. There was not a motion for rehearing filed. There also was no request that the matter be treated as a matter of great public importance and that it go to the Supreme Court. So the opinion that you all have is the final opinion. I will tell you that this particular decision led to a 123 different arbitrations that were filed from homeowners in the same subdivision. It's a matter of public record. They were originally filed in a lawsuit. We were able to get them all moved to arbitration, and the first five decisions are also filed in the court file now, and interestingly enough, even before the appellate court had entered its decision, the arbitrators had ruled in our favor and determined that this was not unlicensed contracting. There were no treble damages entered, no punitive damages, no attorney's fees, nothing like that. And the way this matter is proceeding now is in arbitration. you know, and up in Jacksonville, obviously, in front of a panel of arbitrators with respect to AAA arbitrations. So that's basically the sum and substance of the background of the case and the issues that were raised. I got a couple of questions here via email, and then I can probably have Hardy allow people to orally ask questions if they want to afterward. But among the questions that I have gotten on licensing are, you know, whether a complaint deals primarily with just the qualifier or the company. And I think the answer is both. The company is responsible for the alleged unlicensed contracting damages, the attorney's fees, the treble damages, all that sort of thing, which are provided by statute as a penalty. But the qualifier, if the qualifier doesn't supervise the project properly, or doesn't make sure that any damages or repairs are dealt with appropriately, could suffer the consequences of not being properly responsible for that particular home or that particular job in general. The Construction Industry Licensing Board, obviously, completely separately deals with administrative complaints, as they did in this case, that are filed. And as I mentioned earlier, in this case, they determined that there was no evidence that this was unlicensed contracting, and in fact found that there was not even probable cause to open up a case on that particular issue. Now, if you're on the plaintiff side of this case, obviously, you know, the argument is, well, geez, what penalties are out there if the construction work is not done well? What penalties are out there if the qualifier is hardly ever on the job or isn't on the job or just does a horrible job or there are a bunch of building code violations? And I think the answer is there are remedies for all of those things. If there's a building code violation, there's a statute that provides a remedy. If there's a warranty, there's a cause of action under the warranty, which there was in this case, a warranty. If there's a problem with the construction, arguably you can file a negligence action in addition to the breach of warranty or breach of contract. That is not completely clear right now under the current economic loss rule whether a delivery of a home is a, quote, product, end of quote, and if so, whether there is still a negligence claim. But in this case, that really didn't matter one way or another. The big issue was whether there was unlicensed contracting. The other claim that was brought that would have allowed attorney's fees or punitive damages was a FDUPTA claim, and that particular claim did not go anywhere. We won summary judgment in front of the trial court on that, and that same claim was brought in the arbitration proceeding, which, again, you can find in, as part of the trial court records, the decision of the arbitrators that this did not constitute FDUPTA. The argument being that by putting the company's name out there as an unlicensed contractor or as a licensed contractor and not having someone on the project sufficiently to satisfy the claimants, that somehow is a deceptive and unfair trade practice. That claim, as I say, was not successful either in the trial court or in the arbitration proceeding. But I guess the lesson here is that if you get a bad ruling and you're representing the builder or arguably even the subcontractor, if it's a licensed subcontractor, and an innovative lawyer or law firm is on the other side and they come up with an issue that would get them something other than just compensatory damages, it makes the claim a lot more appealable and I don't mean by on appeal, but it makes the claim a lot more attractive to a group of homeowners or a group of plaintiff's attorneys, both of which we had in this very case, to bring the claim. And, you know, they, as everybody probably is aware out there, there's a lot of claims being brought throughout the state for stucco defects and various kinds of alleged construction problems. Several years ago, we had siding issues. And if you were able to take those claims and change those from just recovering for the bad siding or the bad stucco and convert those into treble damages and punitive damages and attorney's fees, boy, there'd be a whole lot more litigation than there already is, and there's plenty of it now. So those are kind of the issues that were raised in this proceeding. Again, in summary, it's a fraud claim was brought, a fiducia claim was brought, a breach of warranty was brought, a negligence claim was brought, as well as the unlicensed contracting. And in the unlicensed contracting was, it is, you know, there's a punitive statute that allows for treble damages, but it's really brought as a substantive claim for unlicensed contracting, and a separate substatute allows the recovery of treble damages when the contractor is unlicensed. That issue has hopefully been brought to rest. I know there were a lot of nervous contractors out there, probably commercial as well as residential, with the argument being if your qualifier is not sufficiently qualified or isn't out to the project enough or obtain the permit properly, that this would open you up to those kind of damages, and it simply is not the case. Those kind of damages are not recoverable, and they shouldn't have been recoverable to begin with, in my humble opinion. I'm a little bit of a defense lawyer on this particular argument. Now, if you look at the answer brief that's part of the materials, you will see the arguments that were made, and the first argument is a little different than what was made at the trial court, and that is that the actual person who obtained the permit, the actual qualifier, has to be the one who supervises the project. Number two, the determination of whether a business organization is licensed depends upon the responsibility and actual supervision. And number three, that, you know, if a person doesn't supervise sufficiently, there is no, quote, responsible contractor on the project, and therefore the company is unlicensed. And then, of course, the argument that sort of flows for all of these arguments is that there is a public policy mandating, you know, punitive damages or penalties to the unlicensed contractor, and there's no question that is the case. But if I can go back to each of these appellate arguments real quickly again, there's nothing that requires the same qualifier to be the person that supervises the project as the one who pulled the permit. If that was the case, then every time a qualifier left the company and you didn't replace them immediately, if you or the qualifier died, you couldn't do any more work. It doesn't make any sense at all to me. The second question, again, responsibility. That is a key issue. The qualifier is, quote, responsible for the job, and the primary qualifier from a business organization is responsible for every job. Now, in this particular case, being responsible is different than actually having to supervise every project, every aspect of every project. Does the qualifier have to be out there when the concrete is poured? And does the qualifier have for every single house? Does the qualifier have to be there when the topping of the roof is done on every single house? How about when the three layers of stucco are put on? Do they have to be there for all three layers of the stucco? What about when the the interior work is done on the house? How about the framing? Do they have to be there when every single part of the aspect of the framing is done in the field? And does that particular qualifier have to look at every single piece of the framing on every single house? You can imagine that A, it's impractical. B, no one does it that way. And C, you do have a remedy if something isn't done correctly. It simply doesn't mean that you're unlicensed. The third point is that the effective date of the contract, there was no licensed individual and that there was some fraud in obtaining the building permit. I don't think that signing the permit applications in blank, albeit maybe not a good practice, means that they were fraudulently obtained. There certainly was an intent to build that house. The permit was, in fact, paid for, and the municipality, in fact, inspected, or a private inspector, once the construction was finished. So there was no fraudulent building permit obtained, but frankly, even if there was, or frankly, even if there was no permit obtained at all, the company would potentially have to pay a penalty, a fine, have to pull a permit after the fact, any number of things, but the company wouldn't be unlicensed. That's the sum and substance, and that's what the appellate court ruled. And while it is absolutely true that the legislature wanted to penalize unlicensed contracting and put in a subsection of the statute awarding treble damages and attorney's fees for that practice or lack thereof, I'll be honest with you, and as an experienced construction lawyer, if I were on the plaintiff's side, I would have never even thought to assert unlicensed contracting. It would have been simple for me. I would have looked up to see whether that contractor had a license, as we always do, and if the contractor had a license, I wouldn't have filed a claim for unlicensed contracting. But obviously, much to our surprise, that theme and that claim was successful in the trial court and would have resulted, if it was successful on appeal, would have resulted in treble damages, would have resulted in attorney's fees, and in fact did result in any number of cases being filed that potentially at least never would have been filed but for this ruling at the court. And please don't take any of my comments to suggest somehow that the trial court was irresponsible, the judge didn't know what he was doing or anything like that. That's absolutely not what I'm alleging. The judge had spent most of his career, if not his entire career, on the criminal bench. He was very honest about it. He told us all that he was kind of learning as we were, as he was going through the case. This wasn't his area of practice. I'm not trying to be overly critical of the trial judge from that standpoint. But the ruling obviously was not correct and was reversed on appeal. So, Hardy, do you want to open it up for oral questions?
Absolutely, Neil. Hold on.
Okay.
Conference is now in talk mode.
All right. Everybody should be unmuted and free to fire away.
I only got one written question, so does anybody have any oral questions?
Hey Neil, I got one. There is a Division of Administrative Hearings opinion that's maybe 15, 20 years old, where an employee was held to have engaged in unlicensed contracting because the qualifying agent didn't know about it or something. I'm wondering if there were any.
Yeah, I think I know what case you're talking about, and there are actually two cases that if I were on the other side, I probably would have focused more on than the other side did. But one case deals with the rent a license, and that dealt with Company A goes and pulls the permit, and Company B actually does the construction work, and Company A gets paid a fee. Even though they weren't, their qualifier wasn't really involved at all and really had nothing to do with the work. And I think that may be the case that you're referring to, Hardy. you know, one employee, and that was unlicensed contracting because it was a company that really wasn't involved at all and fraudulently used its license to allow someone else to build a project. That was one thing, and then there's another case out there, another administrative opinion, I should say, where the question was whether someone else could be the, quote, construction manager, end of quote, and still satisfy the licensing requirement. And the construction manager in that case would have been the licensed contractor. The party to the contract would not have been a licensed contracting. And again, the DBPR held that that is not proper. The party who does the construction needs to be the party to the contract and the party who holds the license. And, you know, it obviously it's fine to have someone acting as the construction manager as long as the party to the contract also is a licensed contractor and has a qualifier licensed as of the date the contract is signed. Otherwise, theoretically, an unlicensed contractor could just go around signing a bunch of contracts, have very little assets, if any, and then go hire somebody who is licensed and shield that person or that company potentially from some liability.
Yeah.
So both of those are instances that I think are much different than our situation and could potentially lead to an unlicensed contractor claim.
You know, I've got a question. This is Jason.
Sure.
What do you think about that last paragraph of that order had some language that bothered me a little bit. It said, although appellant may have violated the law by building the home with a contractor other than the one whose name appears on the permit.
Yep.
Some other things. So what's your reaction to that?
The only way I read it, and obviously I don't know exactly where they were going, is that you may be suffering some administrative penalty for the permit issuance. But, again, that doesn't make you unlicensed. That's the only thing I could get from it. I honestly don't know what the appellate court was, where they were going with that. But that's my best guess. And, again, if we didn't have a permit at all, we definitely would suffer some sort of an administrative penalty. And so that was the basis for my educated guess, which is all it is.
Anybody else? Any other questions for Neil? All right. Neil, unless you have any other further wisdom, we'll call it a day. Thanks very much for the great presentation.
Thank you all.
Thanks, Neil. Thanks, everybody. See you next month. Same number.